Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
Hello, listeners of Fully Booked. Our podcast network, Podcast One, has a brand new app for you to discover the show. Find out everything about your favorite Podcast One shows, including Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, through the all-new Podcast One app available now in the App Store or on Google Play. Find links to articles, social media, make playlists with your favorite episodes, and connect with other Fully Booked fans. You can even create your own polls for the latest book releases. We have our own little community on there. Check out exclusive content such as behind-the-scenes photos and so much more. And if you have 360-degree video or watch a bunch of shows in virtual reality, there's over 1,000 videos on the app right now. It's like you're in the studio. There is no other podcast app like this one. Download the all-new Podcast One app in the App Store or on Google Play today.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller list, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
For me as the writer, the stakes are so high. And for me as a mother, every year it seems like I understand more about the perspective of who pays what for war.
Kristen Hanna is the best-selling author of more than 20 novels, including the international blockbuster The Nightingale, which will be released as a film in 2019. In this week's episode of Fully Booked, we're talking to her about The Great Alone, her new novel set in remote, harsh Alaska, as a former prisoner of war in Vietnam returns home and is brutally changed by war with serious consequences for his family and just about everyone he knows. Welcome to the show, Kristen.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So we gave a starred review to The Great Alone, and our reviewer calls it a tour de force. And it does feel to me like everything comes together so well in this book. The characters, the suspense, the setting, the historical moment. It seems to me, at least, that you felt this story pretty strongly when you decided to write it. Is that the case?
You know, it was interesting. This book was sort of a long journey for me in terms of, you know, finding exactly the story I want to tell. Usually I'm pretty straightforward and I sort of know what I want to do. But to be honest, the success of The Nightingale was just a little bit daunting, and it made it a little bit difficult to sort of know what to write following that. And so, you know, when I began, I wanted to write a book that couldn't be compared to The Nightingale. And I wanted to find something that was very personal. And so, you know, I picked Alaska because I have such a connection to the state. But it took a long time, even with that, to sort of figure out what I had to say. And it wasn't really until, I guess, probably 2 years in that I decided to sort of turn the book on its ear and change it and set it in the 1970s, that it really all started, you know, coming together for me. And I think it was because I sort of realized that the 70s, in a way, mirror a lot of what's happening in our world today. And so it just made this book feel sort of fresh and relevant and kind of important for me to tell. And so once I, you know, came up with that element, the 1970s and Alaska and homesteading and, you know, the undiagnosed PTSD, that's when the story really came together.
And so the book is brand new. So tell people a little bit about what happens in it.
You know, it's interesting. It's a book that's sort of about a lot of things. But at its core, I would say it is a young girl coming of age in a time of sort of political and social unrest, the 70s, with a father who is struggling with undiagnosed PTSD. And, you know, when he loses yet another job, he decides that the answer is to take his wife and daughter north to Alaska, where they will live purer, simpler lives off the grid, live off the land, and, you know, he will find peace. And his wife and daughter are sort of desperate for him to find peace. And so this family goes up almost completely unprepared for this environment and, you know, find a small cabin in a very remote area and try to start their life over. But unfortunately, of course, because the father, Ernst, is a former POW from the war and is suffering from, you know, flashbacks and nightmares, the fact that he has chosen an environment that is dark, essentially, you know, 7 months of the year, really puts this family to the test, and it sort of becomes a novel about survival on a lot of levels for a lot of people.
Right. And I've read your bio and read interviews with you, and I don't think you've ever been a homesteader in Alaska, but I have actually been to the Homesteaders Museum in Soldotna, Alaska, which is one of the settings in your novel. And it's fascinating. And to think that, you know, people were homesteading up into, you know, the 60s and 70s. I mean, it's just fascinating to think about. But the details of how this family sort of builds a home and how they rely on the community to help them. How did you find all those details? Because they're really interesting.
It is just fascinating. Well, my family, my father is an adventurer still. I think he went to look for the headwaters of the Amazon when he was 79 years old. He just continues to sort of keep pushing the boundaries on, you know, where you can go. And in 1979 or 1980, he and my mom went up to Alaska and just fell in love, you know, with the remoteness and the wildness and all of that. And they ended up making friends with a homesteader family. And these two families sort of came together and they built this business together, the Great Alaska Adventure Lodge and Fishing Lodge on the Kenai River. And three generations of my family have worked there. So I've been going to Alaska and I've been friends with homesteaders, you know, for the better part of my life. But even so, you know, once I started doing the research on how they lived and what it was actually like, you know, it was just fascinating to me. And the interesting thing about Alaska is that all of these, you know, sort of, I guess, quirky, individualistic kind of people that you find in the book are exactly the kind of people that you would still find living in Alaska today. You know, it's not unusual to find a woman who, you know, now lives in a yurt and takes her showers at the laundromat, and she used to be a district attorney in Washington, D.C. You know, Alaska just draws a certain kind of person. And I think I say in the book at one point that, you know, Alaska either speaks to you or it doesn't. And if it does, you know, those are the people who never leave again.
Right, right. You've written about PTSD before, and in The Great Alone, one of the main characters suffers from it, even though he doesn't know what it's called. I wonder why you want to keep writing about PTSD.
I think it's because I'm the same age that my character Lenny would have been. So, you know, in 1974, I was 14 years old. And obviously, you know, that means I came of age kind of during the Vietnam War, you know, watching it on TV. And I wore one of those, there was called a prisoner of war bracelet that we wore back then with somebody's name on it who was missing in action. And so I've always been just really aware of the price, I guess, that was paid and the way we as a society treated the Vietnam vets when they came home. And I think it's just stuck with me. And now that we have so much more information, I guess, you know, I just wanted to sort of readdress that and, you know, bring it to the foreground, you know, to keep PTSD and how we treat returning military in the conversation.
Right, right. And you've also written about war before. I mean, the Nightingale, you know, kind of famously is set in World War II France. This one is post-Vietnam Alaska. Why does war keep interesting you, I guess?
You know, I'm actually as shocked by that as anyone. I sort of didn't see that coming. But I think ultimately what it's about is that for me as the writer, the stakes are so high. Mm-hmm. And for me as a mother, every year it seems like I understand more about the perspective of who pays what for war and what it costs and what it means in real terms. And it all kind of feeds into, I think, my passion for telling the stories of seemingly ordinary women, because I think so often women's stories, especially with regard to war, are not told. And so I think that's how it all comes together for me. Yeah. But it's all life or death. And as a writer, you know, you don't get much bigger stakes than that.
And there is there's sort of a beautiful star-crossed love at the center of this novel, and it's between two teenagers. And again, this is set in the 70s, and one of them, they live apart from one another, let's say, and they write letters, and which is something we don't do anymore. Then this is not an epistolary novel, but I wondered how much fun it was for you to think about that.
You know, actually, that whole storyline, just the whole, you know, coming of age in the 70s, because as politically turbulent as it was and as, you know, dangerous as the world felt then, you also look back and think that was so much more an innocent time. And so, you know, to be able to go back as the author and sort of remember and explore first love, young love, and how those kind of feelings, you know, are so sharp and so acute when you're young, and how letter writing and, you know, can create this intimacy and create a relationship over time, whether you're together or not. And I guess that's something that is sort of classically romantic to me. And the novel, I guess, had so many, you know, dark and intense themes and moments that I felt like it needed the buoyancy of this love story, even though it has kind of a Romeo and Juliet aspect that, you know, increases the danger ultimately.
So you do write wonderfully about Alaska. You mentioned your family having gone up there, and you write nicely about both its people and its natural beauty. Is that sort of expertise just from years of having visited there?
I mean, I think it is just really loving the place. You know, obviously you've been to Soldotna, so I assume you've been to, you know, other parts of Alaska, and it's just so breathtaking in so many places and so majestic. And, you know, a lot of people who get to see Alaska, they see it on cruise ships and they see, you know, a couple of ports here and there, a couple of places, but they don't get to sort of see a lot of it, because a lot of it, as we know, is inaccessible. And so I think I just wanted to, you know, share the beauty of this place that I've come to know.
Yeah. Well, you do a great job at it.
Thank you.
Yeah. So you mentioned about 2 years into writing The Great Alone, you changed the setting. I mean, you have written 20 novels, so maybe this wasn't that daunting to you, but if it were me, I would be having a freak out moment.
I was freaking.
Okay.
The first draft, and what I spent 18 months on was, a domestic thriller with an unreliable narrator set now in Alaska, but, you know, set in the current day. And this was before Girl on a Train. So while I was writing it, domestic thrillers with unreliable narrators became quite the rage. And I sort of realized as I was writing that I just didn't think mine was good enough, quite honestly, to compete in the marketplace. And I didn't really want to write something like that if I couldn't pull it off. And so that's when I sort of, you know, changed it all around. But it was definitely a good long dark night of the soul, you know, trying to or making the decision to throw away that much work.
Yeah. No, but it's interesting because I mean,
ultimately, like you said, it came together in a book that it sort of feels like I was destined to write, and a book that is, you know, different. And so, you know, maybe I ended up in the right place all along.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because you're talking about art and commerce, you know, and that can often be an uneasy mix. I mean, the novel's really well written. And yet you were paying attention to the marketplace. So that's really interesting to see how you kind of adapted, you know?
Well, I also happen to be a big thriller reader. I actually really like them. And so it was less, I mean, there was certainly a component about the marketplace, but it was also my own uncomfortable realization that what it took to write a really good thriller was not ultimately what I was interested in. Mm. My strength as a writer is not, it's not plot. It's not hiding the ball. My strength is really character development and, you know, sort of internal thought processes of characters and characters' growth. And I don't really want to hide anything from the reader. I want to, you know, lay my cards out on the table and, you know, tell you what I'm thinking, I guess.
Right, right. So to ask a literary question, you referenced the poet Robert Service in this novel, and he's the one who called Alaska the Great Alone. Tell our listeners a little bit about him.
Well, like I said, my dad was an adventurer, and so we, you know, traveled a lot, and we went to a lot of out-of-the-way places, did a lot of camping, that sort of thing. And one of our family traditions was, you know, the evening roasting marshmallows and hot dogs over an open fire, and my dad would recite these wonderful Robert Service poems by heart.
Oh, wow.
And so by the time we were, you know, I was 13 or 14 years old, we all knew, you know, several of these very, very long, they're sort of epic story poems about Alaska, about the sourdoughs and the miners and the madams and all the gold seekers who came to Alaska and the price they paid and what they found when they got here. And so I just, you know, I loved these poems. I think they were part and parcel of my youth, I guess. And so when I was looking for a title, you know, about Alaska, it just seemed perfect, especially because, you know, when the book ultimately became about survival, you know, so much of survival is about what you are inside, what you have in you, and can you do it on your own? And, you know, when you put, you know, human survival against the dangerous and beautiful backdrop of Alaska, it just seemed like the perfect match.
Yeah, no, it works really well. So back to the marketplace. According to my count, three of your novels are either in production or being adapted for movies. Do you get involved in that process at all?
You know, it's hard to say. I don't think involved is necessarily the right word. I'm certainly really interested in it. I'm definitely a movie fangirl, and I make very serious decisions about, you know, the kind of filmmakers that I want to adapt my stuff. But once I've actually sold it and it's moving along, I try really, really hard to sort of understand that they are two different art forms and, you know, to choose the best people I can and then to let them do their job.
Yeah.
That being said, you know, the Nightingale has such a great team, and it seems like such a wonderful time, you know, to have a female director, female producer, female writer, female studio head making a movie about strong women. And so that's a particularly exciting, I guess, path that we're on right now.
Yeah. And so we'll see that one in 2019, is that the plan?
That's what they tell me.
All right. So this The Great Alone is just out this week, but are you already working on the next thing?
I am. Yeah, I'm you know, working hard, doing research, checking ideas. I have a very unwieldy sort of process where I sort of have an idea of what I want to do. I do, you know, I think I've done 8 months of research now, and then I kind of follow the story to the extent that I can. So it takes me a while to know exactly what it is I'm writing about, but it's, you know, another strong woman trying to figure out how to make her way through difficult times, and it's historical.
Nice. All right. Well, we will be there. The Great Alone was a great read. Thank you, and thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much. It was great talking to you.
Wow, Clay. I didn't know you'd traveled to the 49th state.
Yes. My dad took me on a fishing and hunting trip, and I read books the entire time. So there was not a lot of fishing and hunting going on for me.
Did you come back with any PTSD?
No, but I mean, there's a Homesteaders Museum, as I said, in Soldotna, Alaska, and it is really fascinating to see how people lived. And again, like, this is up into the 70s and maybe even the 80s. So it's just sort of a parallel universe, you know, to the modern America.
The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books right here on Fully Booked.
Many of you listening to this are in your car right now. But do you love your car? If not, we want to help. I'm Todd.
I'm Paul. And we host the Everyday Driver Car Debate podcast.
We help listeners just like you find cars that are fun to drive and still fit their budgets and their needs.
Along the way, we discuss car news, we tell stories from filming cars for our TV and web shows, and we also answer audience questions from you.
So join us every Tuesday and Friday for the Everyday Driver Car Debate.
This is Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Thanks for joining us.
Speaking of the 70s, the 80s, and parallel universes, we're going to turn our attention now from the land of the noonday moon to the city that never sleeps for a debut novel that I think is a really good one.
Great. So tell us a little bit about the writer.
Joseph Cassara's gorgeous debut novel, The House of Impossible Beauties, builds on the myth and the majesty of the House of Extravaganza, the first all-Latin family in New York's predominantly Black, completely creative ballroom community. Set in New York City from 1976 to 93, Cassara's novel is a profoundly imagined account of some of the real people pictured in Jenny Livingston's 1990 documentary, Paris is Burning. Kirkus calls this novel fierce, tender, and heartbreaking, and I'll tell you, this book will break your heart no fewer than four times. I counted. Born and raised in New Jersey, Cassara is a graduate of Columbia University and the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and the recipient of a fellowship from the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown, Massachusetts. He joins us today from Iowa. Welcome, Joseph, to Fully Booked. Congratulations on the publication of The House of Impossible Beauties.
Thank you. Thank you for that beautiful introduction, and thank you for inviting me to the interview.
My pleasure. I'm so glad to talk with you today. And first things first, for the uninitiated, what's ball culture?
Ball culture is centered around voguing and the concept of voguing. So basically, especially in the 1980s, queer Latino and Black youth, sometimes they would run away from home and they would form these proxy families around the Christopher Street piers in New York. And they would kind of band together and support each other. And there'd be a proxy mother and a proxy father, and they would go to balls. And so the families would kind of compete against each other in different competitions, and they would dress up and try and embody kind of each of the categories. So if one of the categories in the ball was executive realness, Mm-hmm. They would try and dress up and embody what they thought an executive would be like. And what makes it especially sad is that the corporate world kind of ignores people of color and people who live in poverty. And so when they're embodying something like an executive, it's because they have this yearning to maybe be a part of that world that really has no interest in them. And yeah. So when they're performing, they're also kind of reclaiming that power and kind of taking the images from the corporate world and kind of putting their own queer spin on it.
So what inspired you to write about the House of Extravaganza specifically?
Well, I am Puerto Rican and Italian, and I grew up in New Jersey, and I felt this kind of connection to the extravaganzas from when I saw them in the documentary Paris is Burning. At the time, I was living in Iowa City, which is a very, very white city in Iowa, obviously, and I felt this kind of psychic and emotional connection to them, this desire to create a community just for Latin people, which is mostly Puerto Ricans in the 1980s in New York. And so I felt like if I had been born 15 years earlier, I wondered, like, would that have been the community that I sought? And as I was writing, I kind of envisioned that. I just felt this strong connection over, you know, space and time obviously couldn't connect us, but in my writing, I felt more connected to them that way.
Now, I've read that you received a pretty potent piece of advice from Ethan Kanan in your first semester at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. Would you mind sharing that with our listeners?
Sure. So actually remind me what I wrote in the piece in the press release. I forget which piece of advice he gave.
The piece of advice is that we should charm the reader first.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So it was the first story that I ever submitted in the workshop, and it was a story about a gay man who adopts two children, a brother and a sister, and they're very young, and then when they're 5 years old, the daughter dies in an accident. But that happens on the first page of the story. And so basically, Ethan claimed, I think correctly, that the reader is not going to be able to empathize with the situation if it happens on the first page. You know, you kill off a really young character on the first page and they feel no emotional connection. They just feel the melodrama of it. And so his advice was, you spend the entire narrative charming the reader and making them fall in love with your characters. And then when you take them away from the reader, they will be devastated. And so I was thinking about that the entire time I was writing this novel, because, you know, most of the sad things happen at the end, or at least, I mean, I don't want to give away the ending, but based on the time period and based on the people involved, I think that the audience can kind of imagine what type of ending will take place. And but although you don't exactly know what is going to happen to each character, and you read kind of in anticipation of that to figure out what is going to happen. And then when it actually does happen, it feels devastating because you've spent pages with them where they're just kind of falling in love or eating ice cream or cheesecake, you know, and laughing, you know, doing like things, just observing them live their life as people just normally live their life. You know, they're engaging in like whimsical behaviors and they're falling in love for the first time and they're laughing and they're, you know, they're designing outfits that they want to wear to this ball. And you get to see why these things are so important to them. And then when they don't achieve their dreams, or when big major life events happen that prevent them from achieving their ambitions, then it's just so devastating.
Like the character Venus, I too believe in the power of ice cream to bring people together.
So. Totally, yes. Me too. I have a very sweet tooth, so I always have to have sweets when I'm... Well, when I'm writing, I am eating a lot of sweets, but then I think I also incorporate it into my fiction.
I could go for cheesecake, too. That plays another major role in the book. Let's talk about, let's start with Venus, since she was just mentioned. Would you tell our listeners a little bit about her?
So the character Venus is based off of Venus Extravaganza, who's a real person, and she was interviewed in the documentary. And she is a young trans woman who grew up in New Jersey, but moves to New York City. And her dream is she wants to find a rich man who is going to take care of her and pay for her sex change. And she kind of, that is her ambition. She wants to be upwardly mobile. She kind of looks at all of the cisgendered straight women who are able to, like, marry rich men, and they pay for their washer and dryers, and that is kind of her goal. She wants to live in Westchester. She wants all of the kind of the icons and the symbols of kind of wealth in the 1980s, right? Like the yuppie kind of wealth symbols.
Who's her mother, and what's her mother's goal or dream?
Her mother in the house?
In the house.
Yeah, her mother is Angel Extravaganza, who's based off of Angie Extravaganza. And Angie, or Angel, is more practical. She wants to make sure that the house stays afloat. So she thinks about the money that is involved to make sure that there's always food available to them, to make sure that they have a roof over their head. And they are constantly clashing in the novel because Venus is more, she kind of lives in this dreamscape, right? She she engages with the world as she wishes the world would be. And sometimes she places herself in very dangerous situations because of that. Whereas Angel is always like, you know, I love you, Venus, but what are you doing?
Yeah.
You know, you have to be careful. You, like, you don't just live in this, you know, this fantasy world. We live in a very, you know, especially New York City, like, you have to be careful everywhere you go. And and they're constantly in conflict because of that.
Yeah, hearkening back to your description of giving corporate realness at a ball, it reminds me that, you know, there aren't a lot of opportunities for these characters to make money, or a lot of different channels for them to make the money they need to live. And many of them turn to sex work to make that money.
Yes. Yeah. It was like, I think there's a line in the documentary, is like, you either work or you starve.
What was it like writing about sex work for you?
It was a pretty interesting, I mean, I, when I'm writing, I try and, like, deeply inhabit the characters and all of the scenes. And so I wanted there to be a balance of, like, some humor, but then also I wanted the gaze of the narrator to not look away in those moments and to, like, capture exactly what that was like. And I wanted to really emphasize the age difference and the racial and ethnic differences between the characters who are engaging in sex work and the people who are paying them.
Yeah. Right?
And so most of the time, the men who are paying them are much older. They are white. They come from, you know, privileged families, although not always, or in ways that we may not know because we don't really know exactly who they are. And yeah, I wanted the audience to realize just how young they were. You know, they were teenagers, or they were in their early 20s, depending at what part in the book you're in, and that's just so young.
Yeah. You know, and it, so often, you know, these tricks they turn into assaults as well. So your heart is, maybe my heart was broken more than four times, Joseph. Maybe I'm underestimating.
And then I think there's also moments where, because they are so young, they may not actually realize some of the things that are happening to them in the moment.
Yeah.
And that is also really heartbreaking. Or as the narrative progresses, we can see the ways that that trauma affects the way they can interact with each other and their romantic relationship.
It's interesting to me because I see this so much as a story about desire in a lot of different ways. And one of the ways that some of the characters express their desire is in trying to communicate it through their bodies, through touching one another, even through engaging with the city pressed up against other people on a subway car.
Yes.
Was that something that you were trying to look at when you were writing this book?
Yes, totally. I mean, the desire of their body, the desire for the things that they want to have, like the things that they want to be able to buy with money, the desire for fame in some cases. Some of them are just like, they want to be like that white blonde swimsuit model, you know, or, you know, all of these things that are, that they just don't have access to. They want, they yearn for it. And that was also, you know, sad to see them not be able to realize those dreams.
As someone who's writing a fictional narrative about, you know, historical figures, how do you see the role of the novelist? And do you have a duty do you have any duties to the historical record as a writer of fiction?
Yeah, this is like, it's an interesting problem when you're writing fiction, because at least in my experience, when I was going back into kind of archive, not a specific archive, but archive in a general sense, there are gaps where you don't expect there to be gaps, and then you have mm-hmm. to fill things in. And when you're filling things in, that's kind of where the role of the novelist comes in, where the imagination comes in, and you have to be able to use things from your own personal experience and the things that you understand about the world based on stories people have told you to kind of fill in the gaps, to create something yes. that feels emotionally true. Because the role of the novelist is more concerned with emotional narrative truth mm-hmm. than historical truth, right? Like that's the difference yeah. between a biographer and a novelist, or an accountant and a novelist. And I was kind of fascinated. I think Nicole Krauss has this quote where like accountants owe you accuracy, but fiction writers don't. But in a sense, you don't want to be wrong. You don't want to get it wrong
yeah.
because the minute that your reader senses that something doesn't feel emotionally true, it's over for them, right? They're
yeah.
no longer in this dream world that you've created for them. And so you have to create something that, even if it's not historically accurate, feels true to the narrative that you're creating.
Yeah. Well, I was in it to win it. And I think a big part of what sucked me in was this sort of stylized language that you use to depict, you know, thoughts and actually the dialogue between the characters. It is so good. And truly, the shade of it all had me laughing a lot.
Thank you. I like writing the dialogue a lot because it was always... the dialogue was never pre-planned, and it was mm-hmm. always surprising to me. And so whenever the characters are being shady or witty or funny in the moment, it was kind of fun for me to discover that line too. And in a way, it made the characters feel like they were jumping off of the page.
I have just one gem here. On a scale of 1 to Betty Ford blackout, his level of drunk was, say, half-finished martini glass at Liza Minnelli's.
Yes.
That's delicious. And I'm jealous of you for getting to write, you know, such things. It's really, you gave me everything I wanted from this book.
Well, martinis can be very inspiring.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners about the book?
I think that with this book, I was trying to resurrect a story from the past and create a narrative for people to engage with it in the present time, because I think that I'm worried that queer stories are, you know, have been erased and are continue to be erased, and that was kind of my goal. And so I hope that if they decide to read it, that they will be able to engage with the story and see the characters for the human beings that they were.
You are listening to Joseph Cassara. The novel is The House of Impossible Beauties, his debut. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You know, we don't get many novels about voguing and drag queens, so it was great to see this one come down.
And it is also, just like sidebar, a great book to see. I don't know if you've seen the cover of this, but it is gorgeous.
Yeah. It is a great cover.
It has this magnificent face that is just, it's a beauty. This is a keeper, Clay.
Well, great. Well, thanks for talking to him. Let's call up the editors and see which bestsellers are worth your time.
Let's do it.
All right. So this week we've got Eric Liebetrau, our nonfiction editor, Laura Simeon, our young adult editor, and Laurie Muchnick, our fiction editor. Vicky Smith, our children's editor, is away from the office. Eric, what is happening in nonfiction? What are we liking?
Today, I got a new one on the list. It's very timely. It's called Together We Rise, Behind the Scenes at the Protests Heard Around the World. And it's a collection by the Women's March organizers that kind of recounts the events that happened last year, January 21st. And I think this book is particularly timely due to the success of the march a few weeks ago. It's a really good kind of almost coffee table book. It's got photos and essays that celebrate the protest of January 21st, 2017. And it's a good mix of participants and essays from outside as well. And there's some really good essays, particularly by Maxine Waters and also the New Yorker editor, David Remnick. And a reviewer called it an inspiring commemoration of a historic event. I think it's just perfect for this time.
They must have really hurried with that book because
they did. Yeah. And they did a good job. Yeah. It's really well put together.
Nice. All right. Thank you.
Turning now to YA literature. Laura, what's your pick?
So my pick for this week is The Dangerous Art of Blending In. It's by debut novelist Angelo Sermilis. And it's a very sort of raw, painful, difficult book. On the other hand, it's inspired by the author's actual life, and he's now a successful designer in LA, so that kind of lends some hope to the narrative. But it's about a Greek immigrant family, which Sermilis is also from, and a boy who is hiding a couple of secrets. He's isolated because he's not only gay and has a crush on his best friend, but is closeted. He also is being abused physically and emotionally by his mother. And his father is very caring, but somewhat ineffectual. So he really, his only refuge is in his art and in going to Dunkin' Donuts with his dad. Yes. And so our reviewer wrote that readers may need tissues or donuts to make it to the end. But I think this is a really important story.
I am so thrilled that you picked this book because I had the pure privilege of interviewing Angelo for the feature that we're going to run. And I just loved everything about this book, including but not limited to what I considered to be like some of the most authentic, snappy dialogue that I've read in a YA novel in recent history.
That's so great. I didn't know about the profile. Perfect.
Yeah, there's a lot of challenging themes in this book, but he really makes you feel and really makes it work all together.
Absolutely.
Thank you. And what are we lacking in fiction, Laurie?
I would like to recommend a book called Tempest by Beverly Jenkins, who is a well-known romance author. This is the third book in her Old West trilogy. And what's interesting about Jenkins novels is, you know, a lot of historical romances are set during the Regency period. It's all about dukes and duchesses and Scotland and this and that. Jenkins, who's an African-American writer, sets her stories in the Old West in the United States after the Civil War. And they're really notable for depicting African-Americans in a subgenre that's really best known for its unfortunate depictions of Native Americans. You know, when it comes to characters of color, romance novels, Westerns, more known for not so great racial politics. So these books are, you know, they're wonderful romances, beautifully written, really great characterizations. This one starts off with a bang when a woman named Regan, who's gone out west to become a mail order bride, accidentally shoots the man she's come out to marry.
I mean, it happens to the best of us.
Yeah.
Oops.
No. But, you know, of course, they clash, they have great sex, they eventually fall in love, but it's all, you know, the characters are very vivid and nuanced, and it's really a fun book and nicely done.
Oh, great.
I'm actually, yeah, excited about that. I think I'm a romance convert since that Sonali Dev book, A Distant Heart. I think I'm ready for this.
You know, it feels like the moment, you know, romance novels are all about women writing for other women about what they want and need. And they're pretty empowering.
Nice. Well, thank you. All right. So next week we are going to talk to Neil Schusterman, a best-selling YA writer, and we'll ask him about the sequel in his new series. And that sequel is titled Thunderhead. So you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.
Hi, this is Ben Domenech, the host of the Federalist Radio Hour. We're a daily show coming to you 5 days a week from Washington, D.C., where we interview our nation's top journalists, politicians, authors, chefs, economists, entertainers, and more. If you're looking for a contrarian discussion on news, politics, or culture, give us a listen and subscribe at podcastone.com, the new Podcast One app, or at Apple Podcasts.